I'm pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Michael. Great to be here.
Well, when we say be here, I'm in Fremantle. Where are you today?
I'm in Sydney, I'm a bit of a traveller. But I wasn't in Sydney earlier this week. We had, of course, the mayoral debate earlier this week, Michael, which was a good collaboration. And I hope the good burghers of Fremantle took away something from that event.
And they'll be out there voting. You can actually go in next Saturday morning if you haven't posted your vote and take your vote form with you, fill it in and put it in a box in an old-fashioned way in Fremantle Town Hall. So and I was at a big dinner last night, Fremantle Business Awards, where all the competing parties, the mayoral people, or many of them, were all mixing and glad handing around the room, Martin. But where they are really glad handing, and I mean it in a real sense, is in Gaza and Israel, in the light of what President Trump seems so far to have achieved. It on any view of things is momentous. Biden came up with a plan that doesn't look or didn't look so different from this one. But something's happening, Martin. Does this mean that President Trump will win the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, let's deal with that last bit first. On Monday, which was just before the agreement, like a day or two before the agreement, there was a statement that was put out by the Nobel Peace Prize Committee that said that they had made their call on the Peace Prize this year. I think the only way I'd read into that is to say, well, whatever happens this week, we've already done our decision making, and presumably that's to preface any pushback, not just from Donald Trump, but you know, his bevy of different supporters around the world that might think that he's deserving of it. And we will come to this is a big deal. It's a very big step forward. And I think we should credit Donald Trump significantly with it. But on the Nobel Peace Prize, I suspect he might be a week or two too late, Michael, for the 2025 Peace Prize.
Well, it's a bit of a problem, I suspect, because I think formally the nomination dates way back in January, as you'd expect it to be. People need to know, they need to think about this prize, which has been described by the Oxford Dictionary of Contemporary History as the most prestigious prize in the world. I mean, you don't sit down on Thursday and decide, oh, tomorrow we'll award this prize. Well, I wouldn't have thought you do. We'll come back to it. I mean, it's awarded to those people who have, quote, unquote, done the most or the best work for fraternity between nations, for the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and for the holding and promotion of peace congresses. It's fascinating. And I've been to Oslo, Norway, and been through the spaces where this all happens. It's quite fantastic. And the photos of those who have won it and the things they did. Mind you, I can understand if Donald Trump does get a bit annoyed when people say, well, why should you get it? Because he would say, well, Barack Obama got it. You know, what did he ever really achieve? And he was awarded it for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. They cited his promotion of nuclear non-proliferation and a new climate in international relations that he fostered, especially reaching out to the Muslim world. That's back in 2009. I mean, it seemed a bit strange that without actually having done anything except that, you'd win the prize. So why shouldn't Donald?
I think that Donald Trump might have a point on the Obama issue, in that everyone around the place thought that this was way too premature. It was within the first year of his presidency. Mind you, this within the first year of Donald Trump's second presidency. But I think it might have even been within the first 6 months. It was not long in, and he'd really not achieved anything of significance, that of great significance, that you would say deserves, as you say, one of the most sort of highest profile, you know, international prizes in the world. And I would say perhaps too, if I was on the peace committee, I would say, well, let's have a look at this next year. Because I do think it's a very significant development. I do put Donald Trump at the heart of it. But I also note that we've gone through two ceasefires already before in this conflict. None of them led to anything substantial down the track. This may well do. This looks more promising. So I don't want to downplay it. But at the same time, and we've talked about this before, you have a better assessment of the actual impact of a ceasefire and an agreement over a period of time than you would literally. It's only been concluded this week, Michael. So there's a bit of water to go under the bridge just quietly.
Well, and you said something similar last week on our podcast. You said, "Well, it's too soon to say it's failed, and it's also too soon to say it's succeeded." But my goodness, the Israeli war cabinet has approved the plan. Take our listeners again. They'll be reading things here and there and trying to listen to people through what. In these early stages has to happen. I mean, some of the early steps are now being implemented already. I mean, it's not now just something on a piece of paper.
It is looking promising, and to be fair to Donald Trump, some people might take some issues with his 20-point plan, but it is a plan. There is a longer-term plan there. It's not just a ceasefire. There's some meat on the bones, so to speak, and I think that's something that we should be a bit heartened by. But I'll just talk to a little bit of background and context for your listeners. We all know about the conflict, but in more recent times, Donald Trump has signaled his intent to bring the sides together. And Netanyahu has almost lost a lot of his other international partners and is very reliant on the US to support him in a whole range of international forums. And of course, arming the Israelis as well, let's not forget. For their part, Hamas has become somewhat isolated. They always were in the West, but their own backers, their backers is not quite right, but their own people that gave them harbour, still in contact, liaise with them regularly, a number of Arab states have said to them, you really need to come to the table too. So I think there's a lot of background pressure on both sides to make this happen. And that's where US's relationships with someone like Qatar were helpful, I believe, in all of this. So pressure on both sides to bring this together. From Hamas's point of view, the hostages were almost becoming a liability because it's hard to, they were dying anyway, which is horrific. But they were an excuse for Israel to continue the war, let's face it. So I think from their point of view, this was probably the right thing to do. And in Israel, a lot of domestic pressure as well, and people saying, this is not good enough, it's gone on too long, bring home the hostages, all of that.
Martin, I couldn't believe it, and a lot of people couldn't believe it. I don't think you could believe it that Netanyahu and his cabinet would have authorized firing missiles into an office building in Qatar, where they believed senior Hamas officials were meeting. I think one person got killed, might have been the son of one of the big leaders, but it wasn't able to achieve what they intended, as clever as the strike was. And they never told the Americans, I don't believe, that they were doing it.
I
Well,
think
that
this
must
up.
be a significant part of what's going on or what has happened.
I think this upset, obviously upset Qatar enormously, but also upset the US because they weren't told. And Qatar is a key ally of the US and the Middle East. And I think Qatar's reaction was quite clever. So instead of just saying how abhorrent it was that they did condemn it, I think they got in the ear of Trump and said, Trump, we're hosting your biggest base in the Middle East. We've really got to put a stop to this. And I think they were influential in these discussions. But to be fair to Trump, he's the one guy who can make this happen because he's the one guy probably Netanyahu still listens to.
Well, he can pull the levers. There's absolutely no doubt, and he has here. You have to be careful what sort of things are being done and are being agreed. The media says that Trump says that the parties have, quote unquote, signed off on the first phase of the 20-point plan. So you already made the point last time that a 20-point plan, you work through it slowly, and there might be some deviations, and it mightn't be you can work. You can't really work out whether there's been success until perhaps 20 years down the track. But the first phase, so we've got them agreeing. What has to happen next? Because I think in the next short time over this weekend that we are facing, the handing over of hostages on both sides, political prisoners or prisoners in Israel, the hostages that have been taken, all the remains have to be returned. That I would have thought is going to be a really huge hurdle, which might have a lot to do with the way this thing works out in the long run.
So this is what happens. Their cabinet had to approve it, which they have done. There's now a 72-hour deadline, apparently, that Hamas has to comply with to release all 20 hostages believed to be alive. And there's apparently about 28 deceased hostages as well. Israel, in their turn, would then release about 250 prisoners. They're Palestinian prisoners that are serving sentences in their jails. And I think there's around about 1,700 also detainees from Gaza. So that's part of the agreement as well. And then I think there's some bodies they're going to return as well. Aid is to flow into Gaza as well. That's the next part of the deal. And if that all goes well, then they can move on to the next phase. So that in itself could go wrong. What if Hamas doesn't meet that deadline? What if there's some act of provocation between anyone in Gaza and those Israeli forces? Well, they're still going to be sitting in 53% of the Gazan Strip, Michael. What happens there? There's still a lot of, I think there's still plenty of minefields here that could happen. And remember, there's zero trust between both parties, the Israelis and Hamas, as well.
Well, there's a laying down by Hamas of its arms. There's the withdrawal by the IDF, Israel's defense forces from the area. I mean, everyone's pointing out already that a sticking point is the extent to which Israeli troops will withdraw. Israel says its first withdrawal will see it retaining control of around 53% of Gaza. The White House plan indicates further withdrawals to around 40%, then 15%. So you want to see that, I suppose. And then we're not even getting near the topic that we've talked about, whether Commissar Tony Blair is going to be sent in to run everything, or how are they going to deal with that?
Well, this speaks to the complexities. So let's be clear: any ceasefire is a good thing. It means people are not being killed, not being injured. It means hostages are being returned. It means some good things are happening in the short term. But there's a lot of work to do to get this to work in the longer term. Will Hamas completely disarm? They haven't agreed to that explicitly. Will they agree to go into exile and not be involved in Palestinian governance at all? They certainly haven't agreed to that explicitly. Who is in this technocratic organization? I think without participation from the Arab states, I think it's dead on arrival because it'll just look like a sort of Western colonial project as well. Now, the other guy is Trump needs to be continuously involved here in keeping the parties on track. And we've discussed before that whatever intentions he might have, he does get distracted and he does flip and change his messaging in so many other ways. He would have to stay on message and he has to stay involved for this to work.
The 20-point plan is really interesting. It's the sort of plan, when I read it, that you could have got a group of your smart politics and international strategists to produce. It reads very narratively, if I can put it that way. It doesn't look like a document the lawyers have really drafted. I mean, it starts off, one, Gaza will be de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. Good stuff. Two, Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza, who have suffered more than enough. Good. Three, if both sides agree to this proposal, the war will immediately end. Gosh. Israeli forces will withdraw, blah, blah, blah. And then we get down to what I still think is going to be the critical moment in this. Four, within 72 hours of Israel publicly accepting the agreement, as I've now done, all hostages, alive and deceased, will be returned. And then five, once all hostages are released, Israel will release 250 life sentence prisoners plus 1,700 Gazans who were detained after 7 October 23, including all women and children detained in that context. For every Israeli hostage whose remains are released, Israel will release the remains of 15 deceased Gazans. It's my goodness, it's detailed and it easily verified, you would think, Martin. Not too many, too much room for doubt and backtracking and sidestepping and semantic debate.
No, I think there's some really good things there. They've got to get there. And if you read the plan in full, and this was the interesting thing, because Donald Trump had been pretty critical about the concept of a Palestinian state, but it's there. It is actually there. You've got it's in step 19, so it's a fair way to go, but actually, it says a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood. So, if that was implemented in full, it's a fairly comprehensive plan. I'm just not getting it. I mean, I welcome it. I think it's a fantastic development. It's very pleasing. I'm not getting ahead of myself in terms of the longer term impact because we've seen a number of these things, false starts in the past.
What it doesn't quite say, you get down to paragraph six then. Once all hostages are returned, Hamas members who commit to peaceful coexistence and to decommission their weapons will be given amnesty. Members of Hamas who wish to leave Gaza will be provided safe passage to receiving countries. So Hamas people, if they've been identified or even put their hands up and say, I am, was Hamas, they're a faction. They've given up their guns. They're given amnesty. They can stay there. Might have families. They might be happy to stay there as it gets redeveloped. But what it doesn't say here is what happens if those Hamas people don't so commit and decommission. But presumably, that's one of the areas for worry, Martin, in your mind, that might give IDF the excuse to say, well, there's a whole lot of people there who haven't done that, and we still have to eradicate them.
Well, I think this is one of the more complex aspects of the whole proposal. You'll remember the de-Ba'athification of Iraq. For some observers, let me unpack very quickly. The Ba'ath Party, Ba'athist Party, used to run Iraq, and the head was Saddam Hussein. They toppled Saddam Hussein, and they said no one from the Ba'ath Party is allowed in government. And of course, what do they all do? They all led insurgencies once the US was running the show. So either they're going to be involved in some way, shape, or form, or they're probably going to be on the outside punching in. It's a this this it's quite messy. Conversely, in Northern Ireland, as unpleasant as the IRA might be to plenty of people, they were in the process and they continued into governance. And our people didn't like that, but it actually led to a more peaceful outcome. So just some food for thought there.
Except to then get down to paragraph 13 of the 20 points. Hamas and other factions agree not to have any role in the governance of Gaza, directly, indirectly, or in any form. It's how you do that, I've got no clear
Well,
idea.
the other point that I would make is who's Hamas? Now, of course, there's formal people in Hamas, office holders, leadership, and all of that. That's easy to work out. If you go down on the ground, those people that accepted a gun from Hamas and fired at Israelis, where do they sit in all of this? There's a lot of people that are sort of broadly involved in one shape, way, shape, or form. Where are they in all of this? I don't think they'll find that there's a really easy delineation line down the track.
You jump down these points. Number 15 is the United States will work with Arab and international partners to develop a temporary international stabilization force to immediately deploy in Gaza. I noticed President Erdogan of Turkey suggested that they'll be offering people to help out. I think probably in that ISF group. It's sort of encouraging when you hear that.
That's been a missing element, and I think it'd be really welcome for Turkey, Qatar, a number of different states. It can't be one because the problem is there's actually politics between states in the region as well. But if it's multinational and sufficiently multinational and well coordinated and cohesive, it's got the best chance of success.
Well, Martin, I come back to the question. Will Donald Trump, should Donald Trump be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize? We're not on the committee. He can be nominated by a range of people. usually comes from governments, but other people can do it as well. There's no problem in finding people who can properly nominate him to the committee, and I'm sure there's a whole lot of valid nominations in that sense already with them. But perhaps some of them were there prior to the cutoff date, because he's been talking about this for some time, the Donald, his desire to be awarded this prize. The question is whether they can take into account everything that's just happened. You're skeptical. You don't think it's going to happen just now.
I'm a bit of a fence sitter. Like I said, I really welcome this development. It's very good. I don't actually mind. I think there's a lot of good things in the plan. So it's not so much a criticism of Trump. You give credit where it's due, I think, Michael. But I do also see a lot of potential minefields here that remain on the horizon. In many ways, this could go wrong. And I think it's going to need a lot of willpower and push from a number of people to continue that momentum.
Well, I have to say, mainly using Obama's award as the precedent, where you get some award for looking like you're going to do something good, but Trump's well ahead. He's already got these parties to say they agree. Whether or not it gets fully carried out is another thing. But I'd award him the peace plan. I know he's done a whole lots of other things around the world we probably don't like, including at his. In his own country of the USA, but I'd give him the prize, Martin. Are you prepared to
I'm
say no?
going to now with the Peace Prize is about to be announced. I would say let's look at the 2026 Peace Prize, okay? And actually, you'll have a whole year's worth of ins and outs to properly assess the value of this. You're going to make a better decision in 26, in my view, to something that's just a couple of days old.
Well, Martin, we'll finish off by trying to grapple with this question. I have a sneaky feeling that if he's successful there, particularly if they gave him the Peace Prize just now, that he'd say, "Wow, I'm moving on to the next field. America's no longer sort of looking inward. Let's get back to Putin and Ukraine and sort that out
So
quickly."
you would give him the 25 Peace Prize, Michael.
Yes, I would.
Fair enough, fair enough.
Well,
And you
I'm
reckon it'll
thinking.
encourage him. That was the view around Obama. He'd just started, he'd made a few noises, a lot less than this, in my view, but the intention was to encourage him.
Exactly. And there's things to be solved. He needs to get in and work out the Ukraine. I reckon he can do it.
All right. He's got your vote. He doesn't have my vote for 25, but I'm open to 26.
I'm not sure whether I'll receive fan mail after making these
I
pronouncements.
know this will be interesting. You might get a bit of blowback from listeners.
I might.
Watch.
Well, we'll find out, Martin, next week when you and I meet on View from the Roundhouse. Lovely talking to you.
All right, look forward to it, Michael.